Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Welcome to another edition of Life Behind Bars. I'm Noah Rothbaum, the Daily Beast half full editor. Joining me as always is my colleague and co-host, David Wondrich. How are you, Dave?
I'm doing well. Yourself?
I am doing well. I can't believe we've been doing this podcast remotely for a year instead of sitting across from each other. We are sitting across from each other via computer screens.
It's much less amusing this way, I will say.
It is true. It is true that it is not quite as fun as the first 50 or 60 episodes or 70 episodes that we did.
Wait, we've done that many?
Well, this is actually episode 80. So thank you all of our loyal listeners who've made the journey with us through all the years and through all the different topics and bartenders and bars. We appreciate you listening. We started last year kind of at the beginning of the pandemic, like many people, kind of looking back to the 1918 influenza outbreak and the last major pandemic and, you know, how that affected people and how that affected bars and bartenders and drinking. And we have a couple of interesting episodes from a year ago about the history of things like rock and rye and other pandemic cocktails and
medicinal drinks
and
all that kind of stuff.
You know, it only seems fitting now that, fingers crossed, knock on wood, that we're kind of on hopefully the other side now coming out of this pandemic with people getting vaccinated. And I mean, there's a lot of talk about what went on after the 1918, you know, influenza outbreak kind of finished in 1920, or at least sort of began to finish in 1920, since it sort of lingered on, but how that kind of, you know, helped create the roaring 20s.
There's a whole anticipation of people going ape, you know.
Yes.
And a new roaring 20s, and you know, I'm definitely here for it. But a lot of what, when it comes to what we cover, a lot of the talk about the 20s and prohibition and drinking during prohibition is, I hate to use the term, but it's utter horseshit.
Yeah. Fake news. Fake news. I mean,
fake news. There are a lot of myths. There's the myth that I keep hearing, even to this day, that all the classic cocktails we drink date to prohibition. And that's simply not true.
Absolutely. I mean, that's often one of these things where you do interviews or you talk to people and they always say, oh, like this is prohibition cocktails, right? And you're like, not technically. Actually, pre-prohibition would have been the golden age, not prohibition.
I've got this article that Esquire magazine published in 1948, where they photographed 37 of the most popular drinks of the day, right? And almost all of them are drinks that we still recognize today as classics. And this is sort of the canon of mixed drinks that have come down to us. And I just went over it. And you've got like the zombie, the planter's punch, Tom and Jerry, gin Ricky, mint juleps, Singapore sling, pink ladies, daiquiris, clover clubs, all these drinks that we recognize today, sidecar, Rob Roy. Out of these 37 drinks, only 5 were invented during Prohibition.
I can't even believe it was that many drinks that were invented during Prohibition. I mean, usually we talk about just 1 or 2, you know.
When I mean during Prohibition, I just mean during the age.
Yeah.
Because a lot of these were foreign drinks.
Right.
During or after Prohibition, only the zombie, the between the sheets, the white lady, the sidecar, the Frisco cocktail, you know.
Yeah.
That's not a lot.
No.
Everything else that we think of as prohibition drinks was actually before prohibition.
One of the great factors for this is that The Great Gatsby, obviously the F. Scott Fitzgerald book, comes out you know, in April of 1925, right? I mean, right, you know, we're about 5 years into Prohibition, or about 5 years after the Spanish flu is over. You know, World War One is obviously ends in 1918, at the end of 1918. So The Great Gatsby had such an effect, you know, on people and readers, and such a like enduring popularity that I think it's really in many ways colored, you know, our view of what Prohibition was like, you know, in the Roaring Twenties. And that's just one slice of what was going on during Prohibition. That was just, you know, one aspect. Right. Everybody wasn't partying in lavish, you know, mansions on Long Island, drinking, you know, French champagne. But that's sort of come to represent the whole of Prohibition, I feel like.
Butterfield 8.
Right.
If you've ever read that, John O'Hara, party girl on the Upper East Side, or and her kind of sordid but very racy life, and you know, in the speakeasies of New York. That stuff really, you know, it impressed a generation. It impressed a lot of people who weren't living in the cities that had lots of speakeasies, and they were sure that everybody in the in these big cities was just going ape, which, you know, some people were, to be, right. odd, to be honest.
Sure.
But people still worked jobs.
You know, it's several decades of really, you know, calamitous events. I mean, Prohibition movement really begins to pick up, you know, steam in the late 1800s, right? Where we see some states, right. start to implement some kind of prohibition laws. Certainly after the turn of the century, some states go dry and they stay dry for decades. World War One, you know, and then the Spanish flu, which, again, I mean, we spoke about this a year ago, but I don't think, you know, modern historians really give the Spanish flu the due that it deserves, the recognition of for changing people's, right. behavior. Up until recently, we didn't really talk about it, you know, and its influence, you know, it was mentioned, it was sort of a side note, but obviously it was a deadly virus that took many people's lives. It really shaped the world, you know, just as we see the coronavirus shaping ours.
Yeah, I mean, I think we didn't understand it until we started going through it, and partly because they didn't really talk about it at the time. Because, you know, when we say the war ended in 1918, it didn't actually end then. It was an armistice. It was a ceasefire. And nobody knew exactly if it was going to like start up or what was going to happen in 1919.
Right.
So it was still wartime. And at the height of the Spanish flu, because it was still wartime, the press was told to really downplay it, you know, because that was giving information to the enemy.
Right.
By the time people could talk about it, it was over and nobody wanted to talk about it. They weren't howling at the time. They were howling, but it just wasn't being covered.
Yeah. And the flu itself also kind of drags on too. Like officially it's over in 1920, but it kind of keeps coming back, you know, popping up with hot zones, you know, for a couple of years. So, and then of course in America, you have Prohibition starts like right after this. So it's these three major events, you know, sort of back to back to back that shape our world. And in the process, we kind of lose everything that we know about cocktails and spirits. Because by the time Prohibition's over, it's 1933. Bars and bartenders haven't been able to function normally for decades at this point. So people kind of have to relearn what they are and what real cocktails are. And you see it in advertising. And, you know, you recently wrote a story about a fascinating pamphlet that Brown-Forman put out in 1934, which is a great story that Dave wrote a couple of weeks ago for Half Full. If you haven't read it, you should, about
Prince Martin.
Amazing bartender Prince Martin Louisville. But you know, the book at the beginning is basically, the purpose of it is to tell people like what good cocktails are, to like reteach them about cocktails after Prohibition.
Yeah, there's nothing fancy in there, you know. These are all simple drinks.
Yeah, it's like, this is what good whiskey tastes like. This is what good cocktails taste like. And that's all because of Prohibition. And we lost all of this, and people were drinking all types of things during Prohibition.
Yeah, there are some myths about what people were drinking during Prohibition besides just cocktails. Dueling myths that you and I were discussing, and you pointed out that some people today like talk about how all the cocktails were great, and no, they weren't. There was a lot of just really simple rot gut stuff mixed with ginger ale. Ginger ale sales went through the roof during Prohibition. They just kept soaring and soaring and soaring because it was an easy mixer. At the same time, there's also the myth that all the booze was crap.
Right.
And that's not true either.
Right.
You know, there was a lot of stuff being imported.
That's kind of the hard thing. If the truth is somewhere in between those two different things, right? Where it's, you know, I remember talking to Gary Regan about this years ago, our friend and colleague, and he was like, look, you're drinking in a speakeasy. You're not going to linger over a drink for hours, you know, taking your time. You're going to take your shot and you're going to leave before the police kick down the door and arrest everybody. I mean, obviously, you know, that was one view of, you know, that clearly that was his fantasy, or the type of Prohibition speakeasy Gaz would be drinking it would be, you know, some clandestine, you know, subterranean, you know, bar. But, you know, on the other end, you know, you have these amazing private clubs and bars, and just
there was like the Carousel Club in New York that had a merry-go-round like the Carousel Bar at the Hotel Monteleone in New Orleans still does. And you sat at the merry-go-round, and some of the best jazz musicians in New York used to play a novelty act there where they played on like ukuleles and kazoos, and the drummer beat on a suitcase wrapped with brown paper with drumsticks, and the rich patrons used to pay the drummer to sit in on the suitcase, and he made a ton of money by letting people beat on the suitcase.
That's amazing. That's
and,
amazing.
You know, and that was just like upper class hijinks.
Right.
So there was that. For me, like the perfect metaphor for what Prohibition was like in terms of drinking anyway, was the speakeasy owner, Joe the Marquis Madden, who'd been a sailor and a boxer. He gave his formula for whiskey. He took equal parts grain alcohol, pure grain alcohol, water, and straight bonded rye whiskey, and mixed the three.
Right.
And then added a little bit of caramel coloring. And what you ended up with was something that's one third, you know, whiskey. It's the same, a little under 50% ABV between the water and the grain alcohol. And, you know, it's like a blended whiskey.
Right.
It's okay.
Yeah.
It's not terrible. I've made his formula for events and lectures on Prohibition, and you know, people say, all right, I can drink that.
Right.
It's not amazing, but it's not horrible either, you know.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
As it turns out, the government was, you know, putting out poisonous spirits to, you know, kind of teach people a lesson, right? To scare them about speakeasies.
Yeah.
That was actually going on, which only came out in the last 20 years, I think. But, you know, people were, you know, bottling and drinking all types of stuff that was horrible, you know, that would blind them or kill them, and all types of things. You know, there are all types of alcohol, but only some of them are potable or enjoyable to drink. And obviously during Prohibition, they were all being bottled as potable. But then you have, you know, you still have a lot of booze coming from Europe, going through Canada and other places, coming in, you know, from the Caribbean, you know, being smuggled in, you know, a boon of rum and
tequila coming in from Mexico. You've got, you know,
whiskey being made in Mexico too, coming over the border, right? I mean, it's, you know,
for
a lot
the American market.
Exactly. And, you know, a lot of the definitions that we have today in geographic, you know, restrictions that only bourbon can be made in America obviously didn't exist during Prohibition. So you see sometimes these amazing bottles, you know, of Mexican made bourbon, you know, from this period. And it's, you know, it's this weird thing where, you know, you also have medicinal whiskey being sold. I mean, it's this giant business. Like, it wasn't legal to make or ship alcohol, right? The Volstead Act forbid that, but there was a loophole for medicinal, you know, whiskey, where because doctors and, you know, dentists would prescribe alcohol, you know, for a range of different ailments, and you know, it was a real thing.
Doc, I got a pain.
But obviously during Prohibition, that was, you know, I would say, you know, exploited that loophole. And you get a huge amount of alcohol flowing through pharmacies, right? In these pint-sized bottles being sold. Mm-hmm. And it turns the pharmacies, makes them a ton of money, right? It makes these pharmacy chains very wealthy and powerful. And, you know, they go through so much of this whiskey that there's a distiller's holiday is declared, right? Where distilleries can actually make whiskey because they're running out of stocks that, you know, that they can bottle as medicinal whiskey. So, I mean,
there were only a few of these distilleries, but, you know, some of them were pretty big brands. Old Overholt was one.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, given their connections to the federal government, there was it Mellon who was.
Yeah, well, sure.
So I imagine he was the
who owned it.
And he was like, what, the secretary of the treasury or something?
Treasury, I believe.
Right. So
It helps to know someone.
Oh, for sure. They were more licenses than were actually awarded, from what I remember. So that, like, you know, they didn't even award all of them. But, you know, and you see these amazing, in my book, The Art of American Whiskey, there's a photo from a pharmacy in Sparks, Nevada for Four Roses. And basically, you know, it's like any other, you know, kind of medicine, like there's directions on how it should be, you know, ingested, and essentially like the recipe is like a hot toddy, which is kind of amazing, you know, that the pharmacist has written out on the label.
Yeah.
But this goes back to your original point. I mean, it's nobody is sitting there making, you know, fancy drink, you know, at the pharmacy, you know, you're being given like a little flask of essentially of whiskey to be drunk, you know, at home.
It could only be sold in pints.
Right.
I remember one year for my birthday, the late and much lamented Gaz Regan gave me a pint in a can. See, they were tamper-proof metal cans, the glass inside. Eventually, you know, finally they figured out that's how to do it. We were sitting at a table with a bunch of people, you know, at a restaurant somewhere. So I just used the can opener that came with it and opened the can, and we opened it up and passed it around, and we all had a big healthy swig, and it was and killed the pint. But I wish they had made bigger bottles, I'll tell you that much.
It is interesting too, because the effects of Prohibition are long lasting, because it's obviously 13 full years, right? So a lot of the whiskey that you see being consumed even after Prohibition is over is 17 year old whiskey, right? And
well, it's too old, like we talked about recently
in our conversation with Lou Bryson a few weeks ago. And I came across a story from Life magazine back in the day, where they had gone to the original Pappy Van Winkle's house for the Derby, like right in this period. And what they said is that he's using 17-year-old whiskey for his mint julep. Right. And that's like the whiskey to use. And like now, obviously, people go crazy trying to hunt down a bottle of the, you know, the older Pappy, you know, whiskeys. But here, you know, right after Prohibition, he's using it for his mint julep, I imagine, because the whiskey at that point is so woody and, you know, so old that it
that's all he had, you know.
It's all he had. And it's a great way to, like, you know, mellow it out is by adding sugar, mint, and some crushed ice, which waters it down. But I almost spit out my coffee when I'm reading the story that, you know, here he is, that this is his chosen, you know, method to of drinking his whiskey and making his julep.
But I mean, drinkers back then were no fools. A lot of that 17-year-old whiskey just languished, you know, nobody wanted it after repeal, you know, because it had been sitting there in bonded warehouses since before Prohibition, and it was just woody as like licking the bottom of a drawer. I've had some of that stuff, and it's not good.
Right.
It's, you know, also the barrels that they used were green, so it's kind of piney, and it just really doesn't even taste like modern whiskey, some of this stuff. Some of it is very good, but some of it is really not so good.
Yeah,
it's funny, you know, another one of those myths that kind of does come out of Prohibition, you know, older whiskey.
Absolutely.
Another myth that you hear a lot is that because Prohibition shut down American bars, American bartenders had to all go abroad, and they taught the rest of the world how to mix drinks. Well, some bartenders went abroad. Harry Craddock did, who was, it turns out, not American. He was English. He'd come to America, and then he went back. But The world already knew about American drinks and already had learned to mix them starting in the 1850s and really picking up steam in the 1880s, 1890s. And it was already a done deal. There were already cocktail bars, the Chiro's chain in Monte Carlo, and then was in Paris and London, and then Berlin. Then after Prohibition in Los Angeles, they were all over the place, even in New York. These guys all knew everything about fancy drinks and American style drinks going back to around 1890. They didn't need old American bartenders to teach them anything. Some of these bartenders did go down to Cuba for sure, because American companies owned the hotels down there. So they just switched their personnel from New York to Cuba, something like that. But there were already Cuban bartenders who knew perfectly well how to mix drinks, you know, highly exaggerated and all from an American point of view. And if you look at things from other points of view, you see, well, it's really maybe a little less of the Americans coming and showing everybody how it's done during Prohibition. And people had already figured it out a long time ago.
That kind of blows my mind. I mean, because we always sort of think about it as all the good bartenders left America. And I imagine, you know, a lot of them did not have to really leave America, because a lot of their, you know, fancy clubs and restaurants like the 21 Club stayed open during Prohibition. So they didn't actually have to go anywhere. And if anything, they're probably making more money here than they would have made in Europe.
You could still serve drinks in private clubs.
Right.
So the people who passed the law made sure that they could still drink. Where have we heard this kind of work before? You know, it was just the little people who couldn't get drinks. But in a private club, you know, you were still allowed to possess liquor. You couldn't manufacture it or sell it. But if you, a private citizen, brought liquor, you weren't allowed to transport it. But if you stored it at the private club, you were allowed to drink it. And so that was sort of the loophole they used. That didn't stop clubs from being raided. Like the Pendennis Club was raided in 1930, and Martin Cuneo, the head bartender, was fined. And but everybody in Louisville patted him on the back and said, "Good work, son." You know, and he still kept his job, which was tending bar. Prince Martin, you know, our guy that I wrote the column about, he worked at the Wednesday Club, and he tended bar, he catered, he did everything there. And that started in 1922, which, you know, Prohibition was 1919 till 1933. So that's during Prohibition. Lots of other bartenders, you know, kept their jobs at private clubs. They were put on as like maintenance men or something like that. They were kept on, or waiters, but they were in fact bartenders.
Too funny.
Everything's always more complicated, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it also explains kind of the Roaring Twenties, and that there were good drinks in some of these places, because, you know, top bartenders continued to work there. There's also kind of the myth, the old fashioned, that like people were muddling fruit in their old fashions to obscure, you know, bad liquor, you know, and that's why the recipe changed. But like,
it was already changing in 1916. You know, they were already putting fruit in it, and there was no prohibition then.
Yeah, I mean, at least not a national one. But yeah, I mean, it doesn't sort of hold water, because at the places where you could spend the time to muddle fruit in a drink, they weren't getting raided, and the booze that they were using was probably good Canadian whiskey or scotch or other stuff, Irish whiskey, you know, maybe. But definitely, you know, they were using real whiskey. And in the places where you would have the rot gut, where it might taste kind of funky, nobody is standing there muddling drinks for you. you hope you get a clean glass and a slug of, you know, ginger ale and some of their, you know, whatever mystery alcohol is. I mean, that's, so it's one of these things that were forever, you'd hear over and over again. Oh yeah. They threw in the fruit to cover up the taste of bad alcohol, or cocktails were created during Prohibition because the booze was so bad, and that's why they had to be creative with their mixers. And it sounds plausible, right? I mean, at first blush, it seems to make sense, but it doesn't really, you know, hold up that they would be doing this during Prohibition.
So many of these myths come out of that as like, it's people's dim memories of what happened either during Prohibition or before Prohibition, plus it stands to reason, common sense. And it's not a lot of like looking back on that, because there hasn't been very much accurate history on that's pro-alcohol, put it that way. There's a lot of sociological work that's very anti-alcohol, looking at alcohol as a problem. And once you start looking at it as a problem, you don't really care about like what actually happened, you know?
Right.
You're kind of just saying that stuff isn't that important. That's not the most important part. I mean, one of the other myths that is always interesting, and I always believed this, is that it was speakeasies that brought women into bars in America. And to a certain extent, that is true. And that's a big part of the Roaring 20s, was that there were women in bars. What that misses, though, is that that was already happening before Prohibition. That was already a trend in places like New York and San Francisco. There were already bars for women. There were cocktail bars for women. There were mixed bars. There were all kinds of dance palaces where men and women could meet and drink together. Those are the kind of speakeasies that people think of, are the ones where there was music and men and women drinking together. And that all goes back to pre-Prohibition. That was already the trend. That was already the cutting edge. And that just, it just didn't stop during Prohibition. It wasn't an invention of Prohibition.
Well, I think that, you know, you look at the Hemingway bar in Paris, you know, at the Ritz, and I think if memory serves me correctly, we were both on a panel years ago at Tales of the Cocktail about the head bartender there.
Yeah, Frank Meyer.
Frank Meyer, you know, what's now called the Hemingway bar, because obviously Ernest Hemingway liked it, from what I remember, was originally the bar for women. It was a smaller bar in the back of the hotel, and that Hemingway and some of the other regulars liked drinking with women at the bar that was traditionally reserved for women. And then ultimately it lost that designation that it was for women, because I guess so many men were drinking there. So, I mean, again, you're right. There's all this interesting history, you know, before Prohibition. And
even like the Cuban bars were integrated, and those were always very popular.
Yeah.
You know, many men were perfectly fine having women where they were drinking. These things are always more complicated.
And the other thing that we didn't talk about is also, I mean, the kind of fourth major event is the Depression, right? I mean, that is a huge thing that affects America and the world. And I mean, I think partially gives rise to people drinking at home, right? I mean, where a lot of people traditionally make cocktails at home, they didn't have cocktail shakers, right?
I think, you know, Noah, I'm hoping it works this way. We start backwards with the Depression and the making drinks at home right now, you know, in 2021. We're starting at the end, and hopefully we can go back the other way towards great economic times and everybody partying off the chain for the next decade.
Yes.
And you know, we've already done the economic crash and the everybody sitting around at home drinking. Let's consider that part as red and go back to the other part where we're all in bars together, men and women with live music and drinking simple drinks with ginger ale or even nice cocktails made with hopefully decent booze, and just having a really good time. That's the part I want.
Skip over the Depression, skip over the, you know, the,
yeah,
the
that part.
Prohibition, you know, I think that's been done. My hope in a few months, you know, we'll be doing episodes about our favorite bars reopening, and with any luck, you know, talking to bartenders about what it's like to reopen and what people want to drink now that this is all over. I cannot wait for that to happen. I'm looking forward to actually recording these episodes with you, Dave, in the same room, having a cocktail, fully vaccinated.
Yeah, or maybe a glass of some nice American whiskey or scotch.
Or all. Sign me up for all of it right now. Whatever you want, I'm buying, Dave. It's on me. So we'll bust out the good stuff for this. So cheers.
Cheers.
Dave and I encourage you to drink responsibly always.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.